Mana. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Breakfast All Day. It's a new thing we are doing. I've wanted to do it for a while, called Breakfast All Day a la carte. And these are separate little, like, hash brown size side orders of interviews, conversations, folks who are interesting, who are fun to talk to, theoretically working in film, entertainment, something. So we're starting off our first one. First of all, I'm Christy, and Matt's here too.
I'm here too.
We're starting at our first one.
Trying not to completely geek out over our mid-century modern superstar.
He's a superstar, yes. So Josh Agle is here, better known as the artist Shag.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to see you. And you guys, I wish you guys could see these fellows here. They're both in their tiki chic, which is a
right,
way of life.
I don't think I designed my own shirt, and I'm fairly sure that's your own art on your shirt.
Actually, it's not.
Oh, it's not?
Yeah. I try not to wear my own shirts too much because it's like being in a band and having your band t-shirt on or something.
So somebody's nailed your style really well.
I'm drawn to that.
Yes. So Josh's shirt is like a bunch of cute little fishies, like blue and orange fishies on a brown background. And Matt's wearing one of his many floral Hawaiian pineapple situations.
Yes.
I'm in a sweater.
As usual. Yeah. So for anyone who's listening who's not familiar with Shag's work, perhaps you've seen some of the designs. I think were the first ones you were doing at Disneyland for the Enchanted Tiki Room.
Yes, right. Yeah, so that goes back to 2003.
Right, and you've done, you know, there's the print that was a shirt and some other prints around. I've seen the cantina that you've done. There were some designs you did around the Haunted Mansion. So that might be where some people have seen your stuff. And then, you know, some album covers and various works of art. You've got a gallery here in L.A. and one in Palm Springs,
yeah,
right? Or your own store.
Yeah, right? We call it the Shag Store. It's a gallery, but I didn't want to call it a gallery.
Okay.
I wanted to call it a store, which seemed less daunting. We also have things in there. You can come in and buy socks or coasters or something. You don't have to walk in and spend $5,000 on a piece of art.
Or you can get, like, Matt's phone case. Is a Shag phone case.
Oh, yeah,
case.
The Star Wars phone case.
Yeah, the Star Wars one.
Right. So so you and I first met, Josh. We met because I had the pleasure of going to your amazing, funky mid-century home far, far away in the hills. And we did a piece for a show that I work on here in L.A. for Spectrum News One called The SoCal Scene. And so I had the pleasure of meeting you and visiting with you and sitting with you in... That is your studio, that room in your house, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And Matt, you would love his house because it's just...
Oh,
it's,
sure.
It, he walks the talk. He does. Every element, every piece of furniture, every lighting fixture, every tiki mug in the cabinet...
Well,
is of a piece.
Yeah. And when I started painting, I was painting things I wanted to own and places I wanted to be. And then over time, you know, I was sort of able to realize that in my own life.
It was literally life imitating art.
Yes.
It was art imitating life imitating art.
Exactly.
It has all come full circle now. So how did you know that you wanted to do this? I know you probably drew as a kid like we all drew, but at what moment did it occur to you, like, this is going to be my future?
Unfortunately, that didn't occur until I was 2 years into a business degree at my university.
Where'd you go to school? Cal State Long Beach, right?
Cal State Long Beach, yeah. And I was actually paying my way through college doing commercial illustration and graphic design, trying to get an accounting degree, which seems totally the wrong way to do it. And one day, somebody came into one of my accounting classes and said, we're doing sign-ups for the Accounting Students Softball League. And I thought...
And there is one.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, who would want to play softball with accounting students? They're so boring. And then I was like, wait, I'm one. And literally that week, I went and changed my major to art.
So, and you are one of nine kids. You were the eldest of nine kids, yes?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what did your parents say when you changed your major from accounting to art?
They were both outwardly supportive. Years later, my dad told me when you told me that, I was like, oh boy, he's ruining his life. But
oh, no.
They didn't tell me that. You know, they said, okay, whatever you want.
And they were fine with it.
Yeah.
And clearly it turned out okay.
Yeah, and my dad's an accountant. Two of my brothers are accountants. So it's like deeply ingrained in the family.
Oh my gosh. So you bucked all of that.
Yeah.
You were the rebel. Wow. And it worked out okay, clearly.
Yeah.
What was it like being the eldest of nine kids?
Well, I'm actually a twin, and technically I'm the second eldest because my brother's 9 minutes older.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Does he lord that over you?
No, he doesn't. I'm Even though we're identical twins, I'm 3 inches taller than he is. So I always kind of was the dominant one.
He'll
disagree. Like, but it, you're kind of the experiment, you know? Your parents try everything out on you.
I'm the oldest. I get it.
Yeah. So they're stricter, more disciplined. And then as more kids come along, they're like, yeah, you know, we can loosen up. So you get to see your younger siblings experience things that, that you never got to experience.
I definitely had that happen. I remember my parents, I'm the oldest of four. It's me and my brother, and then I have two sisters. And I remember I was in college, and my sisters were all excited because my parents were taking them to Club Med. Where my
Very
brother,
fancy.
And my brother and I didn't get to go, and I was incensed. It was like, this is, we don't get to go to Club. Yeah. So
I'm the only, so this is all very exotic to me, the idea of having siblings to play with and fight with and share stuff with, so I'm sure it was probably a lot of fun and probably nutty.
Yeah,
times
and
too.
you kind of take care of yourselves because, you know, your mom's busy with the newest baby, and the other, you know, by the time she had her last one, the other eight kids are sort of on their own. So you form this sort of mutual club where you're helping each other out and cooking and doing whatever needs to be taken care of.
And little alliances form, I would think.
Yeah, definitely.
And you guys moved quite a bit when you were young, I understand.
Yeah, my dad, even though he was an accountant, he got transferred a lot. And I spent the first 8 years of my life in Hawaii, which probably makes sense, you know, right, based on the artwork I do. Then we moved back to Southern California. We lived in Northern California, Utah, back to Southern California. So it was all over the place.
So what was it about Hawaii? So how old were you in Hawaii, first of all?
Pretty much from birth to 8 years old.
Okay, so like your earliest memories of the outside world are Hawaii.
Yeah, and my very, very earliest memory of all time is looking at this little patch of lawn in front of my mom's friend's apartment. It was bright green, like the grass in Hawaii tends to be. But it was the grass blades were wiggling on their own. And as I got closer and looked, there was a green caterpillar on each blade of grass, the exact same color as the grass.
Whoa.
And that's my earliest memory of all time.
How old were you?
3, probably.
Oh, my gosh. That's magical.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then you surf, I know, or you have surfed. Mm-hmm. You do surf?
I do surf.
Did you start surfing when you were a little kid in Hawaii?
No, I didn't. No, my parents kind of discouraged it because there was this sort of cliche, but it turned out to be based in reality that the kids who surfed dropped out of high school and smoked weed and ruined their lives. So my parents were like, you know, you guys don't need to surf.
You're going to be an accountant who surfs. That is amazing. And so then you came to Southern California. So how does the Hawaii part of your life and the Southern California part of your life influence your work or your perspective on the world?
Well, Hawaii kind of, you know, once I moved back to Southern California when I was about 9, the Hawaii kind of gets suppressed or you forget about it. At least I did. And then when I was in my early 20s, it kind of came back. You know, I remembered things from my childhood that really appealed to me, sort of that tropical kitsch, you know, the Polynesian pop, whatever you call it. And about the time I started being able to go to bars, I loved going to old tiki bars. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time in LA, there were still quite a few of them around. And I had a group of friends that was kind of our thing to find these, what we called old man bars, you know. They didn't have to be tiki bars, but a lot of them were themed bars. It might be a nautical bar or some sort of like weird Moroccan genie bar or something. Right?
What are your favorites of those?
Well, weirdly, my favorite back then is still around, and that's the Tiki Tea over on Sunset. Oh, yeah.
I have been there many times. Yes. Yeah. So for you guys who don't live in LA, it's long and narrow. Right? It has like the longest, narrowest bar in the world. There's some kind of Guinness record.
It's like the size of a large bedroom. It's not very big.
Right. And it was like one of the last places you could still smoke in when the smoking ban went into effect.
Can you still smoke there?
I think it finally. Yeah. I think because Ray, the original owner, passed away. His sons run it, but I think because he passed away for some reason, that invalidated the grandfather clause that allowed smoking.
Okay, well, good. So, yeah, the Tiki Tea, for those of you who have not been, is known for what? It's a drink called the Ooga Booga. That's one of the famous ones where everyone, like, chimes in and helps say the word while they're making it.
Yeah.
What is the allure of the Tiki Tea? Tell me.
Well, part of it was the drinks, because that bartender was a bartender. His name was Ray Bowen, and he had worked at Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic's, you know, the old original Hollywood tiki bars. And he'd taken his knowledge and opened up his own little tiny bar. And the decor, for the most part, even now, is still exactly like it was when they opened up. And I think it was in the early 60s. So it was kind of stepping into a time machine.
It's amazing. And Matt, this is an area of conversation that you are very well versed in.
Yes. Yeah. Although a lot of those old places aren't around anymore. One of the last ones that's got any age to it is the Tonga Hut.
Yeah, the Tonga Hut.
The Tonga Hut in North Hollywood, which just had their 60th anniversary.
Yes.
And you did the mug for that.
Yeah,
right?
I designed a tiki mug for their 60th anniversary.
Yeah, which was a beautiful mug.
Oh, thank you.
And then, but there's a whole new crop that's popped up. Like Lono has just come in on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, Lono's kind of like classy. Yeah. You know, it's less tiki and more like world traveler, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and then, Trader Vic's is gone. And there was Trader Vic's, which had been at Wilshire and Santa Monica. For years
at the
and years
Beverly
and
Hilton.
Years.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's closed, and that one, and they were kind of talking like the bar was still Trader Vic's, but I think they wasn't the same.
They did like a poolside bar, and they called it Trader Vic's, but that's not Trader Vic's.
No, it's right. So that's gone. There's the Purple Orchid in El Segundo.
Where's that in El Segundo?
Actually, since you may be down that way, I'll have to show you.
Please tell me. We're down there like four times. My son's a hockey player, so we are in El Segundo for a multitude of reasons, like three or four days a week.
Purple Orchid is, that's in El Segundo. That's a fun one.
Yeah, and that's one of the original kind of new tiki bars.
Yeah.
I say new, but it's probably been there 10 or 15 years now.
Yeah, like because there's that whole like new crop that's come back.
Yeah.
Or like the scene has kind of come back. And so, yeah, we say new, but it's...
Yeah. Well, in Palm Springs, there are three tiki bars, and pretty much all of them are 5 years old or less.
That doesn't count.
Yeah.
They're nouveau tiki.
Well, one of them is a branch of the Tonga Hut in North Hollywood, the 60-year-old tiki bar we talked about.
Okay. Right.
They opened a sort of a franchise out there 5 years ago.
I'm surprised, though, that given how much work and time they have put into maintaining a lot of the really cool architecture there and a lot of that cool, you know, 50s, 60s swinging style in Palm Springs. I wonder why there are not still some of the original authentic tiki bars in Palm Springs. Right? You think there would be, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because two of the tiki bars are in spots where tiki bars originally were. Mm-hmm. One of them, somebody opened a coffee house on Palm Canyon, and they found out the building they were in was the original Don the Beachcomber in Palm Springs. And one of the back rooms was still full of all the old tiki decor. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, why don't we just turn it into a tiki bar again? And that's what they did. And it's called Bootlegger.
Okay, good to know.
And then another bar called The Reef is in the Tropics Resort, which originally had a tiki bar called The Reef.
Okay.
So about two or three years ago, somebody reopened that.
So you're in Palm Springs a lot.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us about life in Palm Springs for you. Why is that place magical for you?
Well, I like Palm Springs partly because when I'm out there, I don't have to work. I specifically designed my life so that my house out there doesn't have a studio or a computer with all sorts of art software on it or anything. So, you know, I force myself to relax when I'm out there. And the other thing is that lifestyle and that sort of like thing that's coming back where people wanted to live that 50s, 60s vacation lifestyle that they had seen in movies like Palm Springs Weekend or something. And over the last 10 or 15 years, people have been recreating that, you know, new resorts have opened to give people that sort of experience, a bunch of houses. You can Airbnb a really cool mid-century modern house and live there for a week and pretend that you're Debbie Reynolds or something. I think it just appeals to a lot of people, and Palm Springs has become one of those world-class cities where you just say the name and everybody knows what you mean, you know, like Paris or London or Palm Springs, you know. You don't have to say Palm Springs, California.
Right,
you don't
it's have still to got say, that cachet of kind of like of luxury and kind of escapism to it.
Yeah,
right?
And it wasn't always that way. When I first went out in the 80s, it was so boring. It was all old people and like golf wear shops and tennis shops and
right.
Nothing cool except the bones of these awesome buildings, you know, that nobody appreciated.
And so much of that vibe finds its way into your work, is yeah. prevalent in your work. So what were the earliest glimmers of that as far as you establishing your look, your vibe?
Well, it goes back all the way to my original paintings, which were actually set in tiki bars, and the tiki bars in L.A., one was set in Trader Vic's, another one was set in the Tiki Tea, which we just talked mm-hmm. about. So I'm talking like the first six paintings I ever did. They were all tiki bars. And then by the seventh painting, I thought, oh, I got to branch out. You know, I'm kind of stuck in a rut here. So I painted sort of a mid-century modern party scene, because that was my other area of interest, was the furniture and architecture of that era. And it just kind of built from there.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I find that to be an interesting dichotomy, right? Because that 50s, that late 50s, early 60s kind of jet age aesthetic is so clean and so almost minimalist, whereas you look at the tiki scene and that's, you know, I mean, a place like Trader Vic's or the Tiki Tea has got a lot going on inside it. And one of the yeah. things I find fascinating about your work in even just covering kind of the tiki scene is what you choose to bring into that, what you choose to leave out. And I just find that really, it's an interesting kind of intersection.
Yeah. And when I paint a tiki bar, I can't paint every single like blade of right. palm tree frond and every stick of bamboo. So naturally I have to simplify, which kind of fits in with my aesthetic and kind of gives it, I guess, that shag look.
Right. Yeah. That's, yeah, I find that fascinating. I'm glad you kind of were talking about Hawaii earlier, because one of the things that I find, I mean, I've loved Hawaii, and just what I've realized is a lot of it is it's the similar to like the idea of Palm Springs, like the fantasy of Hawaii, right? Especially that post World War II kind of escapism. And right as Hawaii becomes a state and everyone, you know, and like if you go through the Charles Phoenix kind of presentations, and he talks about that. And just that idea of it's this magical place, and it's you know, I know for me, I'm almost, not that it's disappointing, but you go to Hawaii now to visit, I have friends that live there, and it's such a different experience than what you kind of consume and think, oh, it's this just whisked away, right? And I don't know what I'm even trying to say so much as it's yeah. just, you know, it's, I think that's one of the things I find fascinating is kind of, you know, with that tiki scene, there's a lot of people that it's almost celebrating, you know, you see the posters of Pan Am and, you know, so much, it's like this idea of the travel and the fantastical elements, which I think has a certain appeal for me.
Yeah, me too. And there's still vestiges of that in Waikiki.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Some of the old resorts. Now I think a lot of people go to Hawaii and they don't care about that sort of like mythical Polynesiana,
right.
you know,
but right. You tell the locals like, oh, I want to go to a luau. And they're like, ugh, fine.
Do people do that though? Like, I've never been to Hawaii ever in my life. Do people still go to a luau? Is it
yeah.
like the Brady Bunch episode where you go and
yeah.
do all that stuff?
The big resorts in Waikiki still have like their outdoor luaus
mm-hmm.
where every night at, you know, 5 o'clock or whatever, you gather and they dig a pig out of the ground and you know, they do hula dances and yeah,
you
still like that.
Yeah. Or there'd be like, I don't know if they're still doing Germain's, like there was this big one, you'd get on a bus, you'd have to take a bus all the way out to some, cause it was huge. And they'd bring in like, you know, a couple, like two or three busloads of people. And it was this giant show.
Well, bringing this back to movies a little bit,
yes.
I just saw for the first time in years and years, Blue Hawaii, the Elvis movie.
Oh, cool.
Which is actually probably the best Elvis movie, in my opinion. Maybe tied with Viva Las Vegas. They're not great movies, any of them. But
they're charming.
Yeah, and it totally brought me back to my childhood. But it's that thing now when you see an old movie and how completely politically incorrect it is.
Mm-hmm.
And just things that could never fly now.
Like what? Like what was in there?
Well, in this movie, he plays like a chaperone for a group of high school girls. And
that sounds appropriate.
Yeah.
There's one... totally fine. It's just Elvis. No big deal.
You know, he takes the girls around the island.
Who hires Elvis as the chaperone?
Shows them a pineapple plantation. But there's one girl with a really bad attitude. And he says, what you need is a spanking. And
wow.
I saw it with an audience and everybody laughs. But then he actually grabs her and puts her over his knee and spanks her.
Wow.
Yeah. You know.
Which... it was playful, though. It was okay. Oh, my yeah. God. But since you mentioned movies, so much of movies and pop culture and TV finds its way into your work as well. So what are some of the early influences that movies and TV and things that you loved that have now found their way into your art?
Well, probably the earliest movie influence for me was the first movie, the first grown-up movie my parents took me to. And that was a double feature, actually. It was Thunderball and You Only Live Twice, the
wow.
James Bond
Ooh, okay.
late 60s movies.
That's a good double feature.
Yeah, and that's the first time I'd seen anything besides like a Disney movie or some other kids movie. And so that was my first entry into the world of like adults outside of my own sort of like group of adults I knew in real life who were all very conservative and my parents very traditional furniture in the house. And so seeing sort of James Bond for one, you know, right. the way he was, and the supervillains, which even had a bigger impact on me because they lived in these great lavish houses,
right.
you know, full of great designer furniture and stuff.
Well, and that Spectre lair at the end of You Only Live Twice under the volcano
oh, yeah.
with all of, you know, like it's such a great example of kind of that jet age aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah. The production designers on those movies were so dialed in
yeah.
on that. And so, you know, as a kid, I was like, I don't know if I want to be a supervillain, but I definitely want to have a house that looks like a supervillain lair. Mm-hmm. And I remember after seeing those movies, drawing pictures of like James Bond kind of things and really being influenced by that.
What is the house that's in LA? Is it the Thermosphere? What's it called?
Oh, the Chemosphere.
Chemosphere, yeah. yes. And that's still there and things yeah. get shot there still all the time. And that's an amazing house.
Yeah. I know you can't see it because this is a podcast, but it's sort of a round house on a single pole. Almost like what you saw in the Jetsons cartoon.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's up in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah. It's still there. Yes.
Yeah. It's used in Body Double.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And then I think they do, I don't think they actually use that house, but they kind of recreate it in the first Charlie's Angels movie.
Yeah.
Something
they built
like
sort
that.
Of a bigger, fancier version of it, but definitely inspired by that house.
Yeah. And for a long time, it was kind of dilapidated and nobody was taking care of it.
Yeah.
I think somebody's actually kind
Benedict
of.
Benedict Toshin, the,
oh,
the
right.
guy
yeah.
who owns Toshin, the book publisher, he owns it.
Oh,
yeah.
It's in good hands then.
Yeah, he restored it. And I actually think he lives in the house next door, too. Like, they won't say who owns this house, but the same architect who built the Chemosphere built a house next door to the Chemosphere.
Oh.
And I've kind of tried to piece clues together. I think he owns that house together as well.
So how old are you at this point when you go to your James Bond double feature?
I was 7.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very formative, and it stuck in your brain,
yeah.
clearly.
And the weird thing is that of the two movies, I liked You Only Live Twice better. Mm-hmm. Had a little more kind of science fiction element to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years
like
ago...
the gyrocopter you build out of suitcases.
Yeah. the volcano that opens up
yeah.
and a rocket flies
exactly.
out. So
that movie's bonkers.
You know, I was always talking about this movie to my kids, and finally I was like, oh, you guys should watch it. And I sat them down, and after about half an hour, they were like, do we have to finish this?
They were bored?
Yeah. And I was like, it is kind of slow now. I mean, movies are so much faster paced.
Oh, yeah.
So that, you know, if you grew up in the era of my kids, it just seemed like a slow movie to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially, you know, if you look at like big superhero movies now, like it's constant action
oh,
pretty
yeah.
much. And then even like the banter is quick and snappy. So this is how I met you, Josh, is that you did this wonderful painting that you collaborated on with Stan Lee.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. It's called Life is a Great Big Bang Up, and it's got Spider-Man at the center of it. So tell me about that.
Well, that was one of Stan's last projects he worked on, actually. And he pretty much gave me carte blanche to do whatever I wanted to do. Like I said, well, what do you want to emphasize or anything? And he said, just do what you want to do. So I had to study and make sure that all the supervillains in that image were villains that he had come up with because there were other writers who wrote on Spider-Man.
Oh.
Yeah. And his only request was he wanted a cameo in the piece.
Of course.
Which was, I would have put him in even if he hadn't asked that.
So what's he doing in his cameo in this piece?
He's standing in a skyscraper overlooking the action. Spider-Man swinging through the city, holding Mary Jane. And he's got a couple beautiful women on either arm. Mm-hmm. Because that's kind of how he likes to be portrayed.
Right. And so how was he to deal with? Like, he was of course, a larger-than-life figure. But one-on-one as a person, how was he compared to your expectations of him?
He was really easygoing. You know, I think he kind of came to this huge popularity and success later in life. He was known in the comic book world, but not as, like, somebody you'd recognize on the street, I think, until Marvel started making the movies again, and he started doing cameos, and I think he was just fully enjoying that.
Mm-hmm. And so as far as, he seems like he was pretty hands-off as far as what you did in depicting his work. Was that daunting to work with something that was so revered?
A little bit. You know, my fear was I was going to show him my concept, and he was going to be like, I don't think so. But, yeah, maybe we shouldn't work together.
Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened.
No.
So Captain Marvel comes out. It's out. It will be up by the time this posts. And one thing that's really cool is that in the intro, in the the big Marvel intro, it's all a big homage to the various Stan Lee cameos.
Oh, that's great.
It's really sweet. Were comic books a big deal to you growing up as well?
Not really. My parents, we only got to buy comic books when we went on a trip. Like a long driving trip, they would let us each buy one comic book. So I didn't read them regularly. Mm-hmm. So for me, like the 60s cartoon Spider-Man was a lot more of an influence on this piece I did with Stan Lee. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you bring up, though, that the way he kind of just lets you go, like that sounds not far off of what we know about what's famously called the Marvel Method.
Yeah.
Right? Which was, as you know, especially in the 60s, he would, you know, kind of give broad strokes for a plot to Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko, and they would do a lot, you know, almost so much more work with the actual story, and then Stan would go back in and just write in the dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since Stan Lee was writing these characters, he wasn't drawing them. You know, when I was working on Spider-Man, I was thinking about this. You know, he came up with this concept. Okay, it's a high school kid. He's bitten by a spider. He's a superhero. And then Who originally drew Spider-Man? Was it Ditko or Kirby?
So it was Kirby who did it the first time, and they just weren't nailing it, right?
Yeah.
That was the story, is that Kirby was doing what Kirby does, which is these big blocky figures.
Yeah.
And then they went to Ditko, who really, I mean, even in that first cover with Spider-Man, you could see there's such a difference there.
But, you know, when he shows him the drawing, and he's like, it's red and blue. Like, I can't think of any spiders that are red and blue. Was Stan picturing like a black character with like a black suited character with like a red hourglass on his stomach or something?
Yeah, maybe you have to wonder, right? The coloring in there. Well, or, you know, that always makes me think, you know, now I'm thinking about how the Hulk was gray to begin with. Right.
Wow.
And then it was, and like the first couple of Hulk comics are very gray, and then there's a problem coming back from the printers where he turns green, and then it just becomes, well, all right, I guess he's green now.
Oh, is that why that happened?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine Hulk being anything but green.
Originally, like the very first couple of Hulks, you know, Banner turns into this big gray thing.
Interesting.
And then they get it back, and it's, you know, there's a printing problem with getting the gray consistent, and so it ends up green.
Because there is so much red and so much blue in so many comic book characters that the green really stands out. I mean, there's like Green Lantern.
Were his pants and shirt always purple?
Or was that a printing error, too?
I don't know.
That's an excellent question. We'll do some research and get back to you on that. But speaking of that, how, when you're going to put a pop culture figure in one of your paintings or you know, several movie characters, like you've done a lot of Star Wars stuff, I know, how do you decide who you're going to put in or why you're going to put them in?
I always base it on what appeals to me. So, like the Star Wars piece I did of the Cantina, you know, I'd wanted to do a Star Wars piece, and I wish it were my idea to do the Cantina, but I didn't even think of that. Like, it seems natural for a shag piece because it's a bar.
Right, tiki bar.
Exactly. But it was actually Lucasfilm who suggested that I do the Cantina, and when they said that, it was just like, I am so stupid. Why did I never think of that?
How does that feel when Lucasfilm approaches you, though, that, like, clearly somebody at Lucas is a fan of your work? What does that feel like?
Well, it feels great. I mean, I walk around, like, 29 days of the week. I'm just in my studio working, you know, not getting any sort of outside comment on my work. And so, you know, that happens maybe one day a month where something like that happens. And fortunately, it doesn't happen every day or I'd,
Right. No, I'm just, I mean, not, I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but what I find, you know, the thing that I find fascinating is how it's, you know, as someone who has so come into this scene and, you know, you clearly have such love for kind of the tiki scene. And to now, I mean, I see the way your work gets treated at Tiki Oasis, or I was at when you did there was a event you had done at the gallery here in LA about 6 or 7 months back, and it was packed, or people lined up out the door.
Yeah.
Or the huge line at the Tonga Hut to get that mug. You know, there's got to be those moments where it's almost like, do you look at it with a certain air of almost, it's almost like detachment, like, who is this happening to?
You have to, yeah. Otherwise, I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking, like, people really like what I did, and I got to keep making really good stuff and got to think of new, really cool things to make because I don't want to disappoint them.
Yeah, I can see that.
Well, how do you decide then? How do you keep things fresh so you're not doing the same 6 tiki bars for your entire life?
Well, a lot of times it involves kind of going off on something I did recently and figuring out how I can do that in a different way and a better way. So I'm trying to think of an example. Well, like right now I'm working on a clock that is one of those old cat clocks that the tail.
How cute.
And the eyes move together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't get the eyes to move, unfortunately. But, you know, we've been selling clocks in the Shag store for the last couple of years, and they're cool, but I'd always look at them and think, like, how can I make this better? And then I, you know, great artist steal, so I stole the idea of a cat clock that's tail moves, and I just, you know, I'm currently sort of reinterpreting it in Shag fashion.
Right, giving it the Shag treatment.
Yeah.
What is your process like from the beginning of a painting to the time that you decided it's ready to go out to the world?
The beginning just involves really rough pencil sketches, not very accomplished, sort of quickly done. I look at them and I know what things are supposed to be. And then I refine those drawings a lot of times by taking tracing paper and drawing over the drawing I just did, drawing it better, and then maybe doing that a third time, drawing it again, better, which is not anything I learned in art school or something. I think it's for people who aren't naturally the greatest drawers. I'm an okay drawer, but some of my friends who are an artist, you give them a piece of paper and you say, draw, and they'll just, like, poof, create this masterpiece, you know, with, like, a Sharpie or something. Whereas I'm like, that leg doesn't look right. I need to draw that again, you know, so it looks better. And when I'm finally satisfied with the pencil drawing, I will use my computer to blow the pencil drawing up to the size of the painting. And then I actually take my scissors and I cut out that pencil drawing and I draw around the things I've cut out onto the board I'm painting on. And that's how I come up with the shapes.
And then how do you decide what colors you're going to use for a certain painting?
The colors, that's based on the mood I want the painting to have and a little bit the setting. So, for example, Palm Springs gets a lot more yellows and oranges. L.A. gets more blues, purples. And also whether it's a nighttime scene, daytime scene, things like that.
How do you know that it's finished? Or is it ever?
No, it's always finished.
You're like, yep, I'm done.
It's very rare that I don't know when it's finished. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Occasionally I'll finish a painting and it'll sit in my studio for a while and I'll be like, nope, it needs something else. Mm-hmm. But usually based on the drawing I've done, I keep the painting pretty tight to that drawing.
Do you get anything equivalent to writer's block?
I do, yeah. There have been long periods where I've haven't had any good ideas for paintings and I'll sit around sketching or I'll work on something I think might be a good idea. And then as I flesh it out, it's not a good idea. And you kind of struggle with it. And then eventually you have a breakthrough. I would say my longest sort of writer's block or artist block was probably about 6 months.
Wow.
Where I was working, but I wasn't really happy with anything I was putting out. Mm-hmm. And then I figured out sort of what I wanted to do and moved into that direction. And it was okay after that.
That's got to be hard, though, because it's so subjective. It's not easily quantifiable, like what is good or what feels good to you.
Yeah.
Right?
And other weird things. I mean, as an artist, you're not supposed to take into account the marketplace or anything, mm-hmm. what people want. And I always tell when aspiring artists ask me, you know, what should I do? How did you become successful as an artist? I said, I stopped caring about what other people wanted to see, and I started painting what I wanted to see. Because those six original tiki bar paintings I was talking about, I didn't think anyone was going to buy them, so I painted paintings that I wanted to hang on my own wall. And that's... Those right. were like the most popular things right. I'd ever done
you're
to that point.
You're true to your art.
Exactly.
Right? That's the true expression. It's the stuff that you're most interested in.
Yeah. But I'd been exhibiting in galleries for about 15 years when my gallery director was telling me about, you know, a show I had that had recently opened of mine. And she said, oh, this one painting, I could have sold that like 10 times over. And I said, why that painting specifically? And she said, because it was orange. People like the orange paintings the best.
Oh.
And I was like... Really? And what color do they like the least? Purple. I have the hardest time selling purple paintings. And I was like, why was I never told this? You know, I've been painting purple paintings for the last 15 years. I still paint purple paintings.
I was going to say, if you want to paint a purple painting, that's really hard to say, by the way. Why not go ahead and paint a purple painting?
Exactly.
Right?
That's still how I feel. If the subject matter calls for purple, I'm going to make it purple. Yeah.
So how did you know in the first place that you could do this? Like, how did you know to make that leap and like make yourself vulnerable and put your work out to the world?
Well, I was confident enough in my art skills where, you know, I did art and let people see it and usually wasn't embarrassed or didn't feel like I'd be embarrassed if I showed it. So I never really had a problem letting people see my art. I wasn't confident that I could make a living doing it. Even when I changed my major from business to art, I kind of thought, you know I can make a living. You know, it's probably, I don't know if it's going to be a great living. I may live in a little studio apartment for the rest of my life, but at least I'll be doing what I love. And I just worked hard at it, and fortunately it turned out a little better than my initial expectations.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause the name Shag comes from, well, from your name, of course, but you did an album cover for your band, right?
Yeah. Back in the 80s, I was in a band. This band was called the Swamp Zombies. And we were releasing an album, and I did the album cover. And I thought it would seem really unprofessional if people saw that the guitar player had done the album cover. So I had to come up with a name, and that's where Shag came from.
And it was a surf band, right?
And this band wasn't a surf band. This was more like a beatnik folk.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a little bit of punk influence.
Do you guys still play?
No.
Do you still play?
Yeah.
No. I actually, one of my bands reunited the summer before last to play a festival in Italy, and that was it for me. I realized I just don't have fun performing anymore.
Were you playing electric or acoustic?
Both.
Because my immediate thought is, what does a Shag guitar look like?
I've seen a Shag guitar. He has a cool Shag guitar. Well, a cool guitar in your studio.
Yeah.
Did you design that guitar?
No, I painted it. Yeah. But it's just blue sparkle. It doesn't have any Shag artwork on it.
Yeah, no, I'm wondering what like a Shag shape design.
Oh, yeah, the shape.
Like.
Yeah, that would be cool to come up with.
What, so once you figure out the cat...
Forget the flying V. I want to see a Shag guitar.
The thing with the cat and the eyes and the tail. Get that figured out and then work on Shag guitars. Yeah. I see this happening. That's a really good idea.
Thank you.
So movie-wise, are you still seeing movies? I know you love 70s, 60s films and that makes its way into your work, but I know you love movies now, too.
Yeah, I still go to the movies. I don't, not as much, obviously not as much as you do.
Well, and you have kids, right? And
yeah.
That changes.
Well, they're old enough now where they go to the movies by themselves,
okay.
You know, and come back and report to me. And if I get a good report, I'll go see it. Like my son saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Then he said, I'm going to see it again, like 2 days later. And I was like, oh, I better see this thing.
Oh, I have a feeling you're going to like the way that movie looks. The animation.
Well, I did go see it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite movies of the year. But like, you know, for the 8 movies that were nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture, I only saw 3 of them.
But, what were they?
Roma, which was my favorite of the 3 I saw. Green Book, which I went in with really low expectations, and it turned out to be a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be preachy, but it was funny, you know. Mm. And A Star Is Born.
What did you think of that?
I liked it, but I didn't. It didn't like bowl me over. Mm-hmm. Like I had heard people say, you know, this movie, you know, after they saw it, I'm sure this is going to win Best Picture.
Right. You had the other expectations.
Yeah. So I went in with maybe higher expectations, and it's a good movie. Don't get me wrong, but I prefer Roma and Green Book over that.
What did you like about Roma?
I just loved the. Well, it's set in the 60s, but there are a lot of really bad movies set in the 60s. It was really languidly paced, but the filmmaking just kept me engaged the whole time, if that makes any sense. And little, you know, just things like the first appearance of the father in the movie is when he's pulling into that little covered alley and he parks so carefully, you know, he's only got like an extra inch of space on either side of the car. And he pulls the car in expertly, you know, which says something about his personality. You know, a lot about him before you even see him, before he even gets out of the car. And then when the wife parks in the same space, you know, and just dings up the car all over the place, you know, that says a lot about her personality. And there are all sorts of things like that through the movie that just kept me engaged.
And Roma is shot so exquisitely.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I mean, Cuarón
yeah.
shot it and, you know, won the Oscar for cinematography. What do you notice from an artist's eye when you're watching a film that perhaps the average person wouldn't?
I pay a lot of attention to how the shots are composed. Like, some filmmakers put the action and the central characters right in the middle of the screen, which to me is kind of boring. I like it when they're off to one side.
Right, that rule of threes that they talk
about
in photography.
Exactly. Right? And there are a lot of things that are, like, if you just stopped a film right then and said, why is this a good shot? I could analyze it and say, it's composed well. See, there's one big character, you know, one figure over to the right, and he's larger. And then a little farther back to the left, there are two figures, but they balance them out and things like that. But when I'm watching a movie, I'm not analyzing it like that. But if there are all these beautiful shots like that in the movie, you know, you get this, like, this sense of elevation, you know, and that's what I got from Roma.
Some part of you responds to it just subconsciously, right?
Yeah.
So Roger Ebert used to say, you know, when he's watching a film, that he's reacting to it, and then he's reacting to his reaction to it. And that's kind of how I feel like how we do our job is when we're, you know, taking notes or not taking notes, we're just letting it all wash over you. But we are not artists, and I've not been artists for the last 30 years of our lives, so I'm so curious to know, like, what you think have been some really beautiful films that have really moved you.
Well, no, probably... I don't know if this sounds weird or obvious, but I think the most beautiful film, in my opinion, is 2001: A Space Odyssey, mm-hmm. which is also the movie I've seen more than any other movie.
How many times?
I've probably seen it 25 or 30 times.
Did you see it when they reissued it, like in the last year or so,
no,
in 70?
I wanted to go to Cinerama Dome and see it because... Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really where you have to see
that. That's the place to do it, yeah.
Yeah.
So my husband and I took my son, Nicholas, who I think at that point, I think he was 8. It was about a year ago when they did this. And we went to like a 9:30 a.m. showing at the Arclight. We couldn't get in the dome. It was all sold out. But we saw it in 70 millimeter. And it was so cool. I think I had never seen it on a screen like that. I think I had just seen it on TV, and then to see it with my son, who also loved it and was not bored.
How old was he?
I think he was 8 at that point.
Oh,
he's 9 now.
Yeah.
You know, it was a year ago, so I think he was still 8 at that point.
You know, the movie starts off with fighting monkeys.
Yeah. And ends with a baby, right. So he related to that. But he had a lot of good theories about, like, what happens in that white room. And so, yeah, that is part of what is cool about living in Southern California, is that you do have the opportunity to see amazing, important films.
Right.
You know, blown up the way they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Well, and it's fascinating to see something like that on the big screen, because you see things you wouldn't have ever seen before.
Right.
I mean, I remember seeing Blade Runner for the first time on a big screen and had seen it on home video umpteen mm-hmm. times. And seeing it on a big screen was the first time it occurred to me that Deckard might be a replicant, because all the replicants in that have the gold in their eyes. And there's only one scene where Rachel's asking him, about if she ran, would she follow him? And he looks at her and says, I wouldn't, and looks at her. And for a second, his eyes turn gold. And wow. says, but someone else would. And then it was like, and you don't really catch that on the small screen, right?
Right.
Or similarly, I remember I was in high school when they did the restoration of Lawrence of Arabia.
Ooh.
With the extra footage that they had found. And they were showing it at the Cineplex Odeon that used to be...
At Beverly Center?
No, on Avenue of the Stars, where the agency is now, where William Morris is now. There used to be
Morris Death Star building.
Yeah,
yes.
There used to be a Cineplex. There used to be a Cineplex in there, and we saw it. It was a big 70mm, and that scene where you first meet Omar Sharif's character, and he literally rides in from over over the horizon, and there's that scene where, you know, next to the well, and there's those kind of lines that point at him, and you don't realize, like, you, and that scene takes so long for him to ride forward to where you can actually recognize that it's Sharif, and that scene on a big screen is amazing. It's you kind of look at that and think, I can't ever watch this on TV.
We've been ruined. What are your favorite pop culture characters to paint?
I probably the Planet of the Apes characters.
Why?
Oh.
Well, that movie had a big influence on me as a kid as well. And I was painting in my studio once, and I was watching TV, which is what I do while I paint, actually. And I was watching a documentary about the making of the movie, and they had a photo of the actor who played Dr. Zaius.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting in a director's chair, you know, waiting to go on. And because of his makeup, he was smoking a cigarette, but he had one of those long cigarette holders. And just the image of this ape smoking with a long cigarette holder, I thought, I got to paint this. And he was what was his name? Morris Evans. He was also the father on Bewitched. The grandfather.
Yeah.
And he used to carry this enormous martini glass on Bewitched. So I thought, I got to paint, you know, the ape with the cigarette holder and the martini glass. And that was sort of my introduction into introducing Planet of the Apes characters into my paintings.
That's amazing.
And they used to just pop up randomly sometimes in a painting, like a tiki bar, and there'd be an ape sitting in the background. And then last year, which was the 50th anniversary of the original movie, I actually got a license from 20th Century Fox so I could make legitimate, authorized Planet of the Apes artwork and products. And our whole Comic-Con booth last year was based around Planet of the Apes.
That is so cool. I was about to ask you, actually, are there ever any rights issues? Like, you want to paint a scene, you want to paint a character, and whatever studio owns that says, uh-uh.
Well, there's a weird copyright thing. As an artist, you can basically paint whatever you want. And this goes back to the early 60s when Andy Warhol was painting Mickey Mouse and Roy Lichtenstein was painting Donald Duck. And Disney decided not to go after them legally because they thought it elevated the brand. And that sort of set a legal precedent. But at the same time, you can be sued for anything. So if I painted Mickey Mouse, Disney could sue me. They would lose, but they're suing me, and I have to hire a lawyer, and I don't ever want that to happen.
Right.
So, knock on wood, I've never had a problem with that, and I generally, if it's going to be a high-profile thing, I try and get permission or get a license where I'm actually paying royalties to be able to paint that thing.
One, I would imagine it somewhat also depends on, you know, the likelihood of you being sued depends on how much. Like, I've seen that some of the Planet of the Apes stuff is available through your site on the store links through the site.
Yes.
Right. And so if you're selling lots of prints of those, that would be different than maybe one piece that you do. Right.
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 If it's just a painting in a gallery or whatever, like I did a painting of the band Kiss, you know, and it got a really good response. And I thought, well, I want to release this as a print, but you know, Kiss are notoriously protective of their copyright, and I didn't want to get sued, so I actually had to go to their licensing agent and get a license to be able to paint them.
Interesting, because you think maybe some matter of that might fall under fair use, right?
Yeah.
Or
well,
A
it does.
B.
I mean, that's the thing again. I would win in court, but I'm getting sued. And I never want to get sued, you know?
Right.
Time-wise, money-wise,
yeah.
It's not worth it.
Like when my lawyer calls, when my lawyer used to call me, I would talk as fast as I could because I knew he was charging,
right.
You know? And then I found out later on they charge in 15-minute blocks.
Right.
So like...
So
because I got a 2-minute conversation down to 30 seconds by talking fast, he still charged me for 15 minutes.
It's like the opposite of trying to trace the call on TV, right?
Yeah. So who is still out there that you want to paint? What scenes, what movies, what TV shows still inspire you?
I want to paint Pee-wee Herman.
I can imagine that would be a great fit.
Because his that first Pee-wee Herman movie that Tim Burton directed, still one of my favorite movies. And I actually saw Pee-wee last year. I didn't want to go up to him and say, "Hey, Pee-wee Herman, blah, blah, blah." But
I bet he would have liked that.
Well, actually, somebody else was like, "Oh, do you want me to introduce you?" And I'm like, "Sure." You know, so I went up to him and I said, "Hey, Pee-wee, you know, I'm an artist. I'm Shag." And he's like, "I know who you are."
That's awesome. It must have felt good to hear that.
Yeah. And I said, "I want to paint you." And he said, "I want you to paint me." And then he said, "Okay, bye." So I was like, does he really want me to paint him?
So that might be on the horizon for you at some point.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you go to Comic-Con. Have you been doing that for a while now?
Off and on since the early 2000s.
So you've seen it change quite a bit.
Yes.
For the better?
For the different.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say it's better now than it was. There were things back then that were better. There are things now that are better. But for the last 2 years, I've had a booth, a Shag Store booth, which... is a great way and a horrible way to do Comic-Con.
Right.
Because with the booth, you get all these perks and you know, you don't have to wait into any lines.
But then you're in the booth.
But yeah.
So you can't see what other folks are
doing. Well, I actually, this year I planned it. I was only in the booth 1 hour a day. So people had to come that 1 hour while I was there. And then I got to walk around and see everything I wanted.
Now, will you be there again this year?
Yes.
Okay. And what can we expect there this year?
Still kind of formulating that, but I was thinking maybe a KISS theme booth.
Cool. Very good.
I don't know.
And you're going to Australia soon?
Yes, I'm going to Australia later in the year. That's kind of my second biggest market, if you want to call it people who like
I
your art
that.
A market.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
There's sort of a surf culture there too, a beach culture there.
Yeah. And before I ever went to Australia, it wasn't on my list of places to go because I thought, it's exactly like California. It's not. It's not at all like California. But this will be the 11th time I've gone to Australia to exhibit.
So, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, have fun. You have been so lovely to come and hang out with us, to come and schlep through the rain on this rare, pouring, rainy day in Los Angeles. It's so nice to talk to you and pick your brain. So thank you for coming to our dining room table and being our first little a la carte friend here.
Thanks, Christy. And
yeah, this is going to be
you, Matt.
This is going to be hard to top because I can't think of anyone that Christy's going to bring in that I would be trying to not geek out over.
It's all downhill from here. You set the bar. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in, Josh.
And we're going to do this again with lots of other folks. So come and listen to other ones. And thank you for joining us. As always, it's always been a pleasure. So thanks for sticking around with us. Bye.